This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
My thoughts go out to the millions of people in California worried or on the run as hurricane winds drove superfires across the landscape. A weakened jet stream allowed a polar blast to sweep over the rest of North America. Some of those winds flowed right back over the desert towards the Pacific coast to become a rare hurricane-level Santa Ana. Images from the firefight look like hell to me. Stay safe, friends. But this week we catch up with reporting on extreme heat coming to American cities. Dr. Christina Dahl from the Union of Concerned Scientists reports. Then we check in with Canadian climate scientist Simon Donner on a wide range of big questions about our future. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go.
Radio EcoShock.
It's official. The coming heat waves will be longer, hotter, and stickier. Under any scenario, for the coming climate, Americans are going to face heat like they have never seen before. Christina Dahl is a senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is lead author of a new paper titled Increased Frequency of and Population Exposure to Extreme Heat Index Days in the United States during the 21st Century. Christina Dahl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
What does it take for the U.S. National Weather Service to issue a public heat warning?
Whether or not the National Weather Service issues a public heat advisory or warning depends on where you are in the country. So as a national guideline, the National Weather Service suggests issuing a heat advisory when the heat index is expected to exceed 100 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple of days. And they recommend issuing a excessive heat warning when the heat index is expected to be over 105. But different local National Weather Service offices have their own guidelines, and that's because people in different parts of the country have different levels of acclimation to extreme heat. So if you live in parts of New England, for example, say New Hampshire, they tend to issue a heat advisory at a lower heat index, more like 90 or 95, because the people there are less accustomed to extreme heat. On the flip side, if you live in Texas, where days with a heat index above 100 are fairly common, the threshold for issuing a heat advisory tends to be a bit higher.
Yeah, it's the same internationally. I've noticed that the heat warnings come out in the UK much sooner and at a much lower temperature than they would, for example, in Spain or certainly than in the Middle East, where that's just another day. So we know global warming is already happening. Why did you and your team go to so much work to figure out just how hot it could be?
We know that extreme heat is very dangerous to our health. When the heat index spikes, we see increases in emergency room admissions. We see increases in the rates of heat stroke, which can be fatal. And so we know with global warming that this type of extreme heat will likely get worse. We wanted people to be able to see what was coming and to have a chance to take action to steer our future in a different direction.
Is there much difference between the thing that all the policy documents talk about? They talk about the global mean temperature increase and what actually happens, say, in each American city.
There is. So we see that with global warming, we'd expect the average temperature over the entire year to increase. But that also often comes along with an increase in extreme conditions. So having that average temperature rise just a little bit can push it so that those extreme temperature and humidity conditions become more likely or more common. People tend to acclimate to whatever the average temperature is in their region, but it's much harder when we are faced with a day with a heat index, say, of 105. That's when our health really starts to suffer.
So I think that's about 40 degrees C for our European listeners is around 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Is that right?
That's about right, yes.
So for this study, you used two different possible futures. What did you count as a low emission scenario coming up, and then what did you count as high emissions?
we know that extreme heat is very sensitive to our greenhouse gas emissions, which are our heat-trapping emissions that come primarily from the burning of fossil fuels like oil, coal, and gas. And so we wanted to look at a range of different futures to see what the benefits would be of cutting our emissions quickly and dramatically. So we looked at a low-emission scenario in which in the very near term, we start to swiftly and dramatically reduce our carbon emissions. And in that scenario, we're able to limit future global warming to about 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. We also looked at a high-emission scenario in which our carbon emissions continue to rise through the end of the century. And in that case, we see a global average warming of about 4 degrees Celsius or about 8 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. And then we looked at a middle-of-the-road scenario where our carbon emissions start to rise through the middle of the century and then decrease after about the year 2050.
Well, supposing I'm listening in Houston, it's already hot and muggy a fair amount of the year. Is it really going to be all that different in 2050 or later?
That's a question we often get asked. People will say, well, I already live in a hot place, and I can use the air conditioning more. I have an air-conditioned home and office, and I should be fine. But the type of heat that we project that places like Texas will feel is truly unprecedented for that region. So we looked at a phenomenon that we call off-the-charts days. So these are days when the combination of temperature and humidity is so hot that we can't reliably calculate a heat index. Historically, in the United States, those conditions have only happened for a couple of days per year and only in the Sonoran Desert. That's the desert region of Southern California and Arizona. What we saw was that even by mid-century, those off-the-charts heat conditions would start to spread across much of the country. And by the end of the century, about 60% of the United States would experience those off-the-charts conditions at least once per year. Those conditions would be highly concentrated in places like Texas, where it's already hot, and you don't need a whole lot more warming to push yourselves into those off-the-charts territories.
Yeah, I was shocked to see in your report that a few areas like eastern Texas, Louisiana, and South Florida are projected to experience 50 to 100 days per year where the humidity index will feel like it's 105 degrees Fahrenheit, over 40 degrees C. That could be 3 months of stinking hot. Is that a lot more than the present generation is used to?
It is. So we see that by mid-century, both the frequency of the extreme heat and the intensity would increase. So people may be used to, say, 20 days per year with a heat index of 100. But by mid-century, we'd be looking at about 50 days with a heat index above 100. So those really miserably hot days that even people in Texas and Florida complain about as being very hot would become much more frequent. But we'd also see a rise in the number of days that are even hotter than that. So it's both the frequency of those unpleasant days and the intensity of them that would really create these unprecedentedly hot conditions.
Are coastal places like San Francisco or New York protected from the coming superheat waves?
Coastal places tend to be a bit cooler than their inland counterparts. San Francisco is naturally a very cool city. The temperature of the ocean water just offshore is very cold, and so it tends to keep temperatures very mild. So that remains the case in the future. We don't see places like San Francisco becoming as hot as Arizona. But just inland from the immediate coast, we do see quite a bit of warming, such that places like the Central Valley of California, where much of the produce is grown for the entire country, become extremely hot.
We're already seeing fires there. It seems like unseasonably early fires. I guess that could be relative to that heat and humidity, too.
That's right. When it's very hot in California and across the western U.S., we tend to see a tendency toward more wildfires and fires that burn greater areas and move faster. So what we looked at in our study was heat index, which is a combination of temperature and humidity. Typically, if we have high humidity, that tends to reduce the risk of fire. When it's very arid or very dry, is when we tend to see higher fire risk in the western U.S.
Christina, are there places in America which could remain relatively safe or really not that much changed in a increase of killer heat where our survivalists can run away to?
Well, we do see places that would remain refuges from extreme heat. And those places tend to be high elevation areas like the Rocky Mountains or the Sierra Nevada. But it's really important to note that even those places get warmer in our projections. And it's also important to note that our study really just looked at the extreme heat piece. So it doesn't take into account the fact that those areas that may be refuges from extreme heat may be seeing increased wildfire risk in the future. Climate change will bring with it a host of different impacts. And extreme heat is just one of them. So I'd be hesitant to say that there's any place in the U.S. where you could completely avoid the effects of climate change in the future.
I noticed reading the study that the doubling and tripling of hot days and super hot days found in your study, it's relative to a pretty recent dateline. You're not talking about a big increase from the year 1900 or pre-industrial, but from 1971 to 2000 as a baseline. That's well within the life experience of some of our listeners. Did that surprise you?
It did and it didn't. So we did look at a baseline that averaged conditions from 1971 to 2000. But we know that in recent years, just the last 5 years, have been the hottest 5 years on record for the U.S. So people are already starting to feel the effects of the fact that we have warmed significantly since the 1970s. So given that we were comparing that historical period to a mid-century time period starting in the year 2036. That's about 50 years from the beginning of that historical period we looked at to the beginning of the mid-century time period. And we know we've seen a lot of warming already in that period. And we are projecting with those scenarios that our greenhouse gas emissions would rise between now and mid-century. So we did expect to see at least some increase in the frequency of extreme heat between that historical period and the middle of the century. But I think all of my co-authors and I were surprised at just how quickly that rise in extreme heat happens.
Right. We don't have to wait to the year 2100 to see this. It's already happening to some extent, but some of the results in your paper show up 2040, 2050.
That's right. Well, within the lifetimes of many of us, and certainly within the lifetimes of our children, that we could be seeing a doubling or tripling in the frequency of days with a very high heat index.
In our Radio EcoShock show for June 5th, 2019, I interviewed Princeton atmospheric scientist Jane Baldwin. She led a study finding not only is it going to get hotter, but a trend of back-to-back heat waves is already showing up. And that'll put more stress on people and on infrastructure in America. Did you notice that phenomenon of heat waves with little relief in between them in your models?
That's a really important question, because when we look at the health impacts of a heat wave, we can see that if temperatures don't cool off at night and people aren't given that opportunity for their bodies to cool off, the health impacts tend to compound. So when you have multiple days that are hot and you're not getting relief at night from those days, the health effects can be very detrimental. In our study, we primarily looked at individual days of extreme heat, but we did do a little bit of digging into how the length of heat waves would change. And even between now and mid-century, we found that the average length of a heat wave would increase. We'd be looking at more frequent extreme heat, more intense extreme heat, and longer lasting extreme heat.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Christina Dahl from the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about the coming new extreme heat in the United States as the world warms. You know, Christina, time after time during extreme weather, TV reporters find some old person saying, well, I've never seen anything like this before. Please tell us, what is a no-analog situation in your study?
So what we call no-analog, or off-the-charts conditions, are conditions where the temperature and the humidity combined are so hot that they fall above the upper limit of our ability to calculate the heat index. So the heat index is often called the feels-like temperature. It's what our bodies essentially are feeling when it's very hot and humid. So these no-analog or off-the-charts conditions have historically only occurred in the U.S. in the Sonoran Desert region. And that's why we call them no-analog, because off-the-charts, because most of the country has never experienced these kinds of conditions before.
And you also studied population exposure, and you had three different scenarios of population growth in the coming America. Why do that? Why work on the days of population exposure?
Even as our climate changes, our population will change as well. So an international group of researchers has created a suite of different population change scenarios, and they're predicated on all sorts of different things, like, you know, whether populism is on the rise and whether we continue using fossil fuels. So there's a huge range of different population projections, not just for the U.S., but for the whole world. So we wanted to know, if we have this increased frequency of extreme heat, how many more people are going to be exposed to it? And in order to really answer that question for the future, we need to think about how population is going to change too. So we looked at a range of different population scenarios, from one where the U.S. population actually contracts slightly to one where it really explodes and becomes much larger. But overall, what we found was that the number of people exposed tends to be more dependent on our greenhouse gas emissions trajectory than our population trajectory. In other words, the choices that we make about our carbon emissions in the coming decades will be more important than any population factors that lead to an increase or decrease in our population.
It's going to be pretty tricky, because there could be waves of climate migration within the United States as people, say, move away from the coasts due to rising seas, or look for places that are cooler. I have a correspondent who moved from Washington, D.C. up to Minnesota because she just couldn't take the hot, stinking days in D.C. anymore. So I think there's going to be millions of people on the move as they try and find a better place during climate change.
Yeah, it will remain to be seen how people in the U.S. or anywhere else respond to an increase in the frequency of extreme heat. We really don't know yet what people in the U.S. will be able and willing to endure. But we do know that many Americans dislike extremely hot days. They limit our activities. They're costly if you're running your air conditioning at home. They threaten our health, and just quite simply, it makes many of us uncomfortable, if not miserable. So the population change scenarios that we looked at don't account for any of those climate-driven migrations that might occur within the U.S. or around the world. They're much more holistic and broader looking than that. But we certainly could see people making the choice to leave hotter regions of the country and seek these more cool refuges in the future.
Now, on July 29th, 2019, you provided written testimony to the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, a hearing on the need for resilience, preparing America's transportation infrastructure for climate change. Christina, what did you tell them about the need to prepare for a hotter future?
We know that extreme heat can affect many types of infrastructure. You can see asphalt deteriorating or even starting to deform when it's extremely hot. We know that trains often need to be slowed down or stopped entirely when it's extremely hot because the rails can buckle. And when it's very, very hot, we even have trouble having planes take off. So there are many ways that extreme heat could affect transportation in the future. And so as we begin to make decisions about our infrastructure and how we're building and what we're building, we really need to be looking ahead into the future. We want our infrastructure to be built to last. And in order to last us 50 years, we need to be thinking about the frequency of extreme heat 50 years from now.
And I'm thinking, too, of farmers. They've got a schedule based on weather and seasons that they grew up with, or at least recently experienced weather. But according to your report from the Union of Concerned Scientists, that experience might become outdated, possibly within two decades. And I wonder if a change in the heat index could threaten our food exports or even eventually our food supply.
Farmers are already starting to feel the effects of climate change. I was at a conference recently and heard from a wine grower in the Pacific Northwest. Her family's been farming the same land for generations. And she said, you know, we are starting to see these shifts in when spring happens and when the harvest occurs. So they're talking about whether the crops that they've grown for generations are going to be tenable in the near future, or whether they're going to have to start thinking about switching their production to different types of crops. So farmers, probably of all Americans, are the most clued in to the seasons and the weather, and they have a wealth of experience and knowledge based on that. As the climate changes, the farmers will likely be some of the first to notice it, and hopefully they will have the resources to be able to respond to it as well so that they can maintain their livelihoods.
Would you call it a no-analog heat wave that just hit France and most of Northern Europe this past summer of 2019?
The heat that hit Europe earlier this year was devastating. The heat index rose, I believe, to about 100 or 105 degrees Fahrenheit, which broke a lot of records in France and in Germany. The fact that we were able to calculate the heat index for that, however, means that it was not a no-analog event. So typically, those no-analog conditions begin to happen with a heat index above 127. So even hotter than what was experienced several times in Europe this summer.
That's interesting, because I did talk to Simone Rousseau, who's an Italian scientist, earlier this year, and he said that temperatures up to 131 degrees Fahrenheit or 55 degrees C could happen in the United States if we keep warming as we're going. So it almost sounds like the Middle East is coming to parts of the United States. I hope we're ready.
When we tried to think about what these no analog or off the charts conditions would feel like to our bodies, we naturally looked to places like the Middle East, where the temperature often far exceeds what we are experiencing in the U.S. Some recent heat waves in India and Iran have given us a sense of what that off the charts or no analog heat feels like. People describe that when you step outside, it feels like you're immediately being wrapped in a hot, wet towel. They'll describe doing things like soaking their sheets in water and sleeping under those. They describe just trying to avoid being outside at all costs. So we do have around the world some precedents for those off-the-charts conditions. It's just that in most parts of the world, we're really not used to them or haven't experienced them at all.
Christina Dahl, tell us about the Killer Heat Interactive Tool, and it's available in both English and Spanish, provided by the Union of Concerned Scientists. So what is it and how do we use it?
You can go to our website, which is ucsusa.org/killerheat. And when you go there, you'll see a whole bunch of different tools. One of my favorites is an interactive mapping tool that allows you to explore all of our data at the county level in the U.S. So you can click on any county and get information about how the frequency of extreme heat is projected to change in that county. You can explore the different scenarios that I've talked about in this program, from a high emission scenario to an optimistic scenario where we really limit our emissions. And you can see how different parts of the country respond to changes in our emissions over time. There's also a great little tool where you can enter your location and just hit go, and it'll spit out the results for you. So you can see if you live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or Indianapolis, Indiana, how extreme heat will evolve for you in the coming years.
I tried that for a bunch of cities where this program is broadcast, and some of them I went, well, that's not too bad, and others I went, oh, boy, that doesn't look too good. you know, on this show, scientists like Peter Ward and John Englander warn that sea level rise will be the first and worst impact of climate change, but I'm thinking after at least 100,000 heat deaths in the developed world since the year 2000, maybe extreme heat will be the most noticeable change in our lives for a lot of people. Your thoughts?
It may be, and it may be that it depends on where you are. We're certainly seeing already with sea level rise that many coastal towns are experiencing more frequent coastal flooding just when the tide is high. It can be a sunny day, but an extra high tide could bring flooding to, you know, parts of downtown Miami Beach or downtown Charleston, South Carolina. So people are seeing that already in their daily lives along the coasts. At the same time, that flooding typically doesn't threaten our health or our lives. And so that's the difference in my mind between sea level rise and extreme heat, that extreme heat is dangerous, and people frequently lose their lives during heat waves. It may be that, you know, living along the coast day to day, seeing the rise in the high tide, you may be experiencing the first effects of climate change, but they may be tenable for a while. Whereas with extreme heat, the more frequently we see these extreme heat events taking lives, causing people to be hospitalized or having to take time off of work and losing their wages due to extreme heat, you know, that may be a more profound impact for many people.
So, Christina, you got your PhD as a paleoclimate expert from MIT and Woods Hole. Why did you move from studying ancient climates to become more of a public voice with the Union of Concerned Scientists?
I got my start in paleoclimate, and it's a fascinating field of research. I was working on trying to understand how the strength and the path of the Indian monsoon had changed over the last 20,000 years or so. But just as I was finishing up my doctoral degree, Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, came out. I don't know if any of your listeners have seen this movie, but it was one of the first to create a compelling and accessible case for how much climate has already changed and where we're headed. And at that moment, I was looking at my data, which looked back at tens of thousands of years, and thinking, is this what we need right now in this moment when we are already feeling the effects of climate change and we know that they're going to get a lot worse? And the answer, of course, is yes, we always need that information about what our history of our climate has been. But for me personally, I felt the urgency of the climate crisis and really wanted to direct my research energy to the present moment rather than looking back in the past. So it's somewhat of a personal decision to think about what would be most satisfying for me.
Where can people go to find out more about your work, Christina?
You can visit our website, ucsusa.org. You can find my blog posts there. If you go to ucsusa.org/blog, you'll see many posts by my colleagues as well. And as I mentioned earlier, you can check out our extreme heat work at ucsusa.org/killerheat.
From the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C., we have been speaking with senior scientist Dr. Christina Dahl. She led the study Increased Frequency of and Population Exposure to Extreme Heat Index Days in the United States during the 21st Century, that was published in Environmental Research Communications in July 2019. You can find links to the science we have talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Christy, thank you for looking into this hot topic and explaining it for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From the South Pacific to the Arctic, Canadian climate scientist Simon Donner is working both research and public outreach. I want to ask him about coral as nurseries of sea life, how it's doing, and about why farmers don't get the climate picture yet, and maybe whether Canada can step up to its role in the rapidly changing Arctic. Professor Simon Donner is from the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia from Vancouver. Simon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, usually I find each scientist with a specialty. How did you manage to spread into such different fields of research, from agriculture to coral in the exotic Pacific?
That's a very good question. It's always quite natural to me. I mean, although myself and the students I work with touch on a variety of subjects, we're basically asking the same question in every case, which is that why does the climate matter? Why would a change in climate, whether it's warmer or colder or wetter or drier, how is that going to affect some part of the environment, and what is that going to mean for people? And so although, you know, I do work in a variety of different areas, we're taking a very similar approach in every area, and really we're focused on solving and trying to solve problems. And so instead of sort of having a lab that has a machine that I like to use, we have a type of question we'd like to ask, and then we find out whatever methods are necessary to try to answer that question.
Well, I think that's cool. Now, regarding changes in the ocean, let's talk about your work in Kiribati. Where is that, and why does coral there matter to us all?
That's a great question. So since really 2005, I've been going to a country called, it's actually pronounced Kiribati, like the T and the I at the end sounds like an S.
Oh.
So Kiribati or Kiribati if you're Australian. And it's in the central equatorial Pacific. It straddles the equator. It's close to the international dateline and is a collection of small coral atolls, so islands that are made of reef that are only, for the most part, a couple meters above the ocean. And it's a place that's extremely vulnerable to sea level rise, which is one of the reasons that I've been doing research there. But the other reason is because it's in the middle of the equatorial Pacific, it has a really unique climate. So coral reefs around the world are threatened by rising water temperatures. And as a result, you know, the warmer the ocean gets, the more frequent we have these events that we call coral bleaching. But the middle of the Pacific's a little bit different. Every time there's an El Nino event, that's the part of the ocean that warms up and affects the planet's climate that year. And so what that means is that the reefs in the middle of the Pacific are kind of used to having these sort of ocean heat waves quite regularly every few years. And that's quite unusual for the tropics. And so I started doing research in Kiribati because I thought that this unusual frequency of heat waves that they experience might mean that the reefs there are a little bit tougher, and it might mean that we could learn something about how reefs could survive in the future from studying those particular locations.
What about the people of Kiribati? Will their homes disappear beneath the waves if the IPCC's more extreme pathways happen?
So, you know, Kiribati or places or neighboring countries like the Marshall Islands, Tuvalu, or people have heard about the Maldives maybe in the Indian Ocean, these are places that are existentially threatened by climate change. There's no doubt about that. But the picture you see on the news is a lot more simple than what's actually happening in reality. And so most journalists that go there, they go there purposely at a time of the year where there's predicted to be a high tide flooding. And so you get this picture if you're just, you know, a casual viewer of the news or reader of these things, that these places are under a 24/7 flood watch. And that's not actually the case. They are really threatened by climate change, but the people in the islands themselves are actually a lot more resilient than it might seem from the outside.
And so what's happening with the coral there these days?
Well, so coral reefs in Kiribati, just like in most parts of the world, are struggling as ocean temperatures rise and as the level of carbon dioxide in the ocean actually increases as the pH of the ocean changes. So Kiribati has experienced frequent what we call coral bleaching events, which is what happens when corals are exposed to unusually warm water. They basically lose their main source of energy and can starve to death as a result. The only thing I would say that's different in Kiribati is because the reefs have had this experience more frequently, they are in some places a bit more resilient to it. But of course, there are trade-offs to resilience. What that means is that there's a couple species that are particularly hard to kill, and those tend to survive on the reef. And so what we're seeing is reefs that are quote-unquote more resilient, but they're not necessarily what you would desire in terms of a coral reef because they have very few species and they're very physically simple, which means they don't have the same complexity of habitat for different fish species and whatnot.
Well, there could be another aspect. In 2017, I interviewed Pankaj Khanna from Rice University, and they studied plateaus of coral reefs from ancient times off the coast of Texas, and they concluded that sea level rise can go up in relatively sudden steps rather than gradual increases. He said bursts of sea level rise can kill off coral by putting them too deep, too fast to adapt. So I was wondering if, in addition to the bleaching you've talked about from marine heat waves, could we also see a situation where coral just gets too deep as sea levels rise faster than they can cope?
That is an issue, but I would say that if you had to rank the concerns for coral reefs, the impact of sea level rise on sort of drowning of corals is a lot smaller than the impact of bleaching. And really the reason for this is that by time, at the rate that the oceans are warming and the rate that we're experiencing an increase in sort of these marine heat waves that can kill corals, by time reefs are really threatened by being flooded, a lot of coral is going to be dead. Right. And the other way to think about it is that reefs, although sea level rise could certainly threaten some sort of deeper reefs, you know, reefs exist, coral can survive at a variety of different depths in the ocean. So even a few meters of sea level rise doesn't mean that corals won't still be able to survive at all.
All right. So let's get our feet back on the land. You participated in several papers on the farm community during climate change. Simon, why did you branch out in that direction?
You know, one of the things you do as a university professor is you advise students. And so sometimes it's not necessarily me that branching out. It sometimes is that we just found this really brilliant student that had some great ideas. And we sometimes what I'm doing is giving advice on how to do the research, how to design it, how to do the statistical analysis and those sorts of things. And so I've worked with a really brilliant student named Kieran Finlatter. He still works with us now as a postdoctoral scholar, who was looking at how farmers make decisions and how they think about climate versus thinking about weather. And it's been really enlightening stuff.
Right. That was a 2018 paper, which you were a co-author, and it was Integration Anxiety, the Cognitive Isolation of Climate Change. So how do farmers see climate change versus the weather? Are they getting the message or are they just struggling with each different situation?
Well, one of the things to know is that they was studying a very specific group of farmers in South Africa because of sort of the unique reliance on rain-fed agriculture and a really unique set of choices that they had there. But I think in general, what Kieran's work was really pointing at was that cognitively, people aren't putting weather and climate in the same box necessarily, because often we think that, well, if you learn how to adapt to variability in weather, you'll be able to adapt to climate. But the problem is in your brain, you're not really putting them in the same box. That means that when climate challenges come up, you might not actually be prepared with the adaptive strategies. And so in some ways, what some of his work was pointing towards was, you know, what type of communication is needed towards some farming communities. And I would say that his findings are those specific to the farming communities he would study. They may be applicable in many other walks of life as well.
Okay, so that study, though, doesn't really tell us necessarily about Canadian farmers, for example.
No, and I'd be wary of extrapolating. I do think there are some general lessons, but I think as, you know, farmers in every province in Canada and farmers even in just sort of different valleys within British Columbia have very different experiences.
I'd like to move on to some climate science here. The scientific research tells us Earth warmed 5 degrees C in the relatively recent past during that period from about 15,000 years ago to 5,000 years ago, just before civilization started to bloom. And I was reading an article by the German scientist Stefan Ramsdorf saying sea level rose by an astounding 168 meters or 550 feet during that time. So I'm wondering, considering human-induced warming is happening much, much faster now, should we expect major changes to our coastlines and where humans can even operate?
Well, absolutely. I mean, sea level rise is a very clear, direct result of climate change. It's, you know, it's happening because of the simple fact that when you warm water, it expands. I mean, you can do an experiment about that on your stovetop, basically. So that's what we call thermal expansion has played a role. And then, of course, is the melting of ice on land. both from mountain glaciers and, as we're increasingly evidence is showing, from the major ice sheets on the planet, from Greenland and West Antarctica. Now, that doesn't mean I think we can use the experience from 15,000 years ago as a good example, because that climate change had a completely different driver. That was us coming out of the last ice age, and the ice ages are caused by changes in the Earth's orbital cycles. And that leads to a lot of creation ice ages. We have a lot of the ice created on land. You know, all of Canada was covered in ice. And so when that ice melts, the sea level goes up as a result. So it's not really a great proxy for what we're doing now. But there is pretty clear evidence that the sea level is rising. And the real concern to me about sea level rise isn't what you're seeing out there right now, where global sea level is going up between 3 and 4 millimeters per year. It's that there's a huge lag between when we put greenhouse gases in the air, how it warms the planet, and how long it takes ice in a large ice sheet to melt. So that means that what we're emitting right now is determining the future of the world's ice sheets for really decades, but centuries, and possibly even millennia to come. And that's why scientists are often saying the sooner we act, the more important it is, because there's this big lag. And if we don't take action now, we're plotting a course that's going to be hard to avoid.
And there's another thing that I have trouble with as a layperson, understanding sensitivity. I mean, we assume Earth's carbon dioxide hit a low during glacial times of around 180 million parts of CO2. Is that correct, around 400,000 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. So generally during what we call the ice ages, CO2 is around 180 to 200 parts per million, and during the quote-unquote interglacials, which is what we're in now, it's around 280 to 300. Now, because of human activity, we've got it up over 400 right now.
So it went up to about 280 before the Industrial Revolution, and yet I'm told there was planet's temperature went up about 5 degrees C. And we've added about the same amount, another 120 parts per million, but we haven't warmed another 5 degrees C. Maybe that's coming in a future some centuries from now, or do I have a basic misunderstanding here?
You know, actually, I'm really glad you asked this. You do have I will say that it's a misunderstanding, but it's a really common one, and I think it comes from how scientists often show these graphs of CO2 going back over time in and out of the ice ages and temperature going in and out of the ice ages. In fact, Al Gore shows that in The Inconvenient Truth. He gets up on a little elevator even at one point and shows, or a little lift to show how high CO2 and temperature are today. So what is misleading about those graphs, not intentionally, I think it's just people not explaining the details, is that CO2 is not the driver of the ice ages. The ins and outs of the, you know, going into an ice age and coming out of an ice age, that's caused by these changes in the Earth's orbit, how circular our orbit is, the tilt of the Earth on its axis, and these things that we know happen over hundreds of thousands of years of time, right? And so there's really strong evidence for this. You can do the geometry of it and figure out that would, in fact, change how much energy the Earth has and how it's distributed and would lead to an ice age. What happens, though, when you go into an ice age is because so much of the planet's land is covered in ice and because the surface of the ocean cools off, that actually changes the Earth's carbon cycle and leads to carbon dioxide being drawn out of the air. And as a result, the Earth cools off a little bit more. So it's like a feedback effect, right? And so then when you come out of an ice age, the ice melts. There's climate changes. It changes the carbon cycle a little bit and puts a bit more carbon dioxide back up into the air, which is a positive feedback, a runaway feedback that causes a little bit more warming. And so I think when people show that graph of CO2 versus temperature going back over time, it's too often seen as a direct relationship where it's a little bit indirect in the historical past. Now what we're doing is we're just adding CO2 to the atmosphere without any changes in the Earth's orbit, and that's directly changing temperature.
Yeah, I was told that the sun is actually slightly cooling and that if we weren't adding these warming gases, we might have been heading towards another cool period.
Well, I don't think it would be very marginal. I mean, it is true that eventually we will head towards another ice age, but we're warming the planet so fast that we can forestall some of that, actually.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian climate scientist Professor Simon Donner from the University of British Columbia. Simon, we hear that people in India and China are now responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than Western countries. What is your reaction to that?
Well, you know, if you just think of basic principles of equality and population, that makes sense, right? I mean, China and India are the largest countries in the world, and I think that the more important metric to look at is the emissions per person. And so Canada, though a small emitter in terms of the total emissions from the country, we're a little under 2% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. We're a tiny fraction of the world's population, about 0.5%. And so our emissions, our emissions per capita are many times that of India, I believe 8 or 9 times that of India, and about 3 or 4 times that of China, right? And so instead of worrying about the total emissions coming from China and India, we should think about what we're doing per person.
So what would a per capita solution look like if we really applied it? Would you and I have to give up travel vacations or fundamentally change our lifestyles?
It's interesting you say that. There's a lot of tension, it feels like, in public discussions these days around, do I have to be making a sacrifice? Can I not go on a vacation, et cetera? And I really think the important thing to recognize here is that as an individual, you can certainly do things to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, right? And there's all sorts of things like how you get around on a daily basis, the type of vehicle you drive, if you drive at all, type of food you eat and everything. A lot of these things that are sort of good ideas anyways that save money and are good for you would also lead to lower emissions. But I think one of the key problems is that for individuals to make those decisions, we need the incentives to be set right. Right, and those incentives have to be set by government, and they can, to some extent, be set by the private sector by how different things are, with the cost of different products and whatnot. And so while I encourage people to do what they can to reduce emissions in their own life, rather than feel guilty about what you can and can't do, I think it's important to try to send the message to your representatives and say, listen, I'd like to make these decisions. I'd like to live a low-carbon lifestyle, but you need to pass policies that makes it more possible for me to make those choices.
And you have an article coming up titled, Canada's Climate Plans Are Not Sufficient to Avoid Dangerous Levels of Global Warming. Tell us about that.
So the article, and I'll be honest, I didn't exactly choose the headline of it, although I don't disagree with it. What I did is I just took analysis that was done for one of the previous Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports on how much carbon there would be left to burn on the planet if we wanted to avoid different levels of warming. And I said if we're being equitable about this, and Canada took a share of that remaining carbon pie, so we took a slice, the slice we should take is probably based on our population. If we want to be sure that everybody's getting a fair chance to tackle this problem. And then I just did some simple math to say, well, what would that mean in terms of what our emissions would need to look like each year going forward? And what it found is that we need to really sharply reduce emissions to avoid 1.5 degrees of warming, I mean, to almost zero by the year 2030, and by about 60% by the year 2030 to avoid 2 degrees of warming. And if you look at the plans from the different federal parties, none of them had a plan stringent enough to get us there. That analysis, though, was not necessarily being critical of the political parties. I was trying to point out that what Canada would need to do our fair share, is such a dramatic reduction in emissions that we couldn't expect any of the political parties to promise that. It's not looking that realistic. And so I was trying to sort of wake people up, including some of our political leaders, to the notion is that it's unlikely we're going to be able to do our fair share, so that we need to think about how we're going to help compensate other countries.
So Justin Trudeau was just reelected as Prime Minister of Canada, albeit with a minority government. And he talks the good talk about climate change, but then he ordered the purchase of a pipeline to carry what I call dirty tar sands oil from Alberta to Vancouver's port for export. He says the profits from the pipeline will help convert Canada's energy supply or something like that. What do you make of his position, and is there hope Canada can do better in the climate fight?
I know that probably a lot of your listeners have been frustrated with Trudeau government's decision about the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. And I get where they're coming from. I was an intervener at one of the hearings, and I did analysis that, you know, argued that, listen, if you approve this pipeline, the emissions that embedded in it from the construction and the extra oil production would probably mean Canada's not going to meet its target. Right. And the way I've always tried to explain this is that he was making a political calculation, not an actual calculation of like emissions math. That being said, I'm actually quite sympathetic to the Prime Minister and what the Liberal government has been trying to do, because I think as we saw just in the vote in the last election, I mean, if you really think about it, the majority of Canadians voted for parties that wanted climate policy, who wanted a price on carbon. But they also voted, if you think about the Conservative and Liberal votes, the majority of Canadians also voted for parties that wanted expansion of pipeline expansion. And so I think that's a real tension that exists in the country, and as frustrating it is for those of us, and I think it includes many of your listeners, that want to see dramatic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we have to be careful about doing so while alienating some of the country. And how, you know, we don't, the federal government doesn't even have 100% control over what happens within the provinces anyways. And so I do think that, although I don't agree with the numerical analysis of it, I do think that what the Trudeau government was trying to do was a reasonable political compromise. And if anything to be frustrated about, it's that they actually tried to offer something to Albertans in Saskatchewan to say, listen, we'll build you a pipeline. You just have to agree to these climate policies, and that Alberta and Saskatchewan wouldn't agree to the policies, at least under the current Alberta government. And that's what I'm frustrated about.
So the near-term climate may be most disrupted by extreme changes taking place in the Arctic. How are you concerned about that, and do you think Canada can step up to its role monitoring those changes?
As I think a lot of listeners have heard, Canada is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world, and that is largely because we are a big cold northern nation and that our higher latitudes are warming a lot faster. I'd love to see the current federal government invest more heavily in monitoring in the north. A lot of things were cut, and a lot of weather stations have actually been cut, particularly during the Harper government, and it's been slow. I don't necessarily criticize the recent Liberal government for this, but it has been a bit slow to get things back up to speed. Canada has a shockingly small number of weather stations with active long-term data sets, and I think we really, I mean, there's so much that could easily and reasonably cheaply be done to improve that.
And on Radio EcoShock, I've warned listeners we can't use the number of deaths to measure the severity of heat waves. For example, the government of France reacted to tens of thousands of deaths in the 2003 heat wave and only lost 1,500 people, they say, in an even hotter time this past summer of 2019. You co-authored a paper about all this earlier in 2019 titled, Can We Sustain Success in Reducing Deaths to Extreme Weather in a Hotter World? What are some of your conclusions there?
That piece of research was led by this brilliant scientist. It was 100% his idea, named Azim Arabi, who's here at UBC. And really, that what that came out from was looking at international databases of deaths from natural disasters. And as I think most people would expect, they've declined over the years because it's one of the great successes of the past century. We've managed to make ourselves more resilient to natural events, whether they be weather events or earthquakes or whatever. Fewer people die than used to in these events. But then we found this one weird anomaly in the data, which was that deaths from heat waves have increased in the developed world. Not the developing world, just the developed world. And realized that was because of these big heat waves that happened in Europe, happened in France. And then this data was compiled before we saw the dangerous heat waves of last year that killed a lot of people in Quebec and Japan. And so you've got this really tough catch-22 where a lot of the actions we need to do to make people safe from heat waves will require, you know, do require using energy. So some of it is just figuring out better air conditioning, right, in a lot of cities, better building design, and just sort of coming up with emergency plans and cooling centers and whatnot. And I think why, you know, you saw a lot of, it was horrible, the number of people that died in heat waves in France in the past, I think about 15 years is when the major ones have happened. But a lot of it has to do with old buildings and people just not having sufficient cooling devices. And so some of that you can do through, like, you know, the technology in the individual building, but some of it can just having centralized planning and having places for people to go on a hot day.
I think it's in Dubai that they are now air conditioning outdoor soccer stadiums, just having little cold air blowing out around people's ankles to keep them alive in very extreme heat while watching sports. So it seems to me that our ability to survive is going to be grid dependent. But now we're seeing in California, they have to turn off the grid due to fires. And so I'm wondering if we're not going to reach a certain point at which we see more extreme deaths again during heat waves just because the grid can't cope and so our solutions don't work.
Well, I think the way to think about the impact of climate change isn't necessarily that everything is going to be worse in the future, but things like this will, you know, the damage and deaths and morbidity and everything from extreme events will be worse than they would have been otherwise if it weren't for climate change, right? The California example, I have to say, is quite unique to California because I think it's a little bit about how the particular electricity system is designed and how long those some of the transmission lines and everything. I'm not an expert on it, but I do think it's quite unique to California. I wouldn't necessarily worry as much about that happening here. But I would just say that with extreme events going forward in the future in Canada, I mean, the things to worry about are fires, heat waves and floods, all of which we can relate to climate change.
As I mentioned in an email, Dr. Andrew Glickson has joined James Hansen and others to warn Earth may not warm in a steady, predictable way. He says we could get a regional cooling due to increasing meltwater flowing off Greenland and Antarctica. What do you think?
The scenario they're talking about, for those of you that have seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow, The Day After Tomorrow is kind of like a crazy version of what they're saying, that it was based on a kernel of science and then they sort of blew it out into a science fiction future. The idea is that if you added enough fresh water into the North Atlantic, it would disrupt ocean circulation in a way that would cool down the warm currents that head towards Europe and make Europe, continental Europe, warmer than Canada, for example, is at the same latitude. So there is evidence that this happened in the deep geological past, and there is some evidence that as fresh water enters the North Atlantic because of melting in Greenland and et cetera, that you would slow ocean circulation a bit. But the assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is that we're not really worried about a sort of complete shutdown of that circulation. That's quite unlikely to happen. And so while I think it's correct to say that the Earth isn't going to warm evenly, I'm not sure that the majority of climate scientists around the world are that worried about the scenario that was being described in the previous interview.
Simon Donner, how optimistic are you about the future? I sense that you're a little brighter than I am about what's going to happen.
Yeah, I am. People are often surprised. They think being a climate scientist must be the most depressing work in the world. And, you know, I think my sister's a neurologist. She works with young children with epilepsy. To me, that's a depressing job. What I do, I think I have a gifted life. I mean, I think this is incredible. We're talking about basically how to make the world a better place, right? And yes, it's scary that we might not be able to get there fast enough. But I guess what I really spend a lot of time thinking about is how most of the actions we need to take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are good ideas for all sorts of other reasons. And the one I think about the most is air pollution. Most of the things that we do to emit greenhouse gases, burning fossil fuels, also is the source of most air pollution. And air pollution killed more people in the last century than the world wars combined. And so just to think that we could, like, tackle climate change and on the side also, like, save people from air pollution. I mean, this just seems like this incredible win-win to me. So I honestly see this as a great opportunity. I'm at the same time worried about a lot of people around the world and people, including people in my own communities. But I just see us as having this great opportunity, and I wish we would just take it.
You've kind of taken up the late Stephen Schneider's call for climate scientists to become public communicators as well. You put yourself out there, including on programs like this one. How's that going, and are we asking too much of scientists?
No, I do this. I think my advice to scientists always is, you know, you should be prepared to communicate things, because sometimes even if you don't want to, your work is going to end up in the public and you'd have a responsibility to communicate it. But not everyone has to be out there. Do what you're comfortable with. I was lucky enough to be trained by some wonderful people, and I was lucky enough to know Steve and have, like, you know, climate communication training from him. And I feel a responsibility based on my own job, but it's also based on being a public university professor, but also based on the fact that the research I do just seems like it's relevant to a lot of people. So if I can help by answering some questions, I'm happy to do that.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to talk to our listeners about?
The one thing I would like to say is that I know a lot of people out there are scared, right? I mean, we heard this warning last year that there's, quote unquote, 12 years left to act. And the only thing I'd like to say about that is that, to be clear, is that the scientific community has never really said that we have a certain number of years left to act and then the planet's going to implode. And that the real message of the most recent IPCC reports is that every action you take counts. Everything we can do counts. And so really, rather than worry so much about these deadlines, I would just think about the fact that the more you can do to reduce emissions, the less the planet's going to warm and the less people are going to suffer.
From the University of British Columbia, Canada, we've been speaking with climate scientist and Professor Simon Donner. You can find links to his website and all the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you for spending time with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please remember, I don't agree with everything every guest says. I call up scientists, experts, and activists to see what they do say, not to hear what I'm already thinking. You be the judge. Hello, Vancouver.
Say climate justice now. Let's try. People gotta rise like the water. Let's solve this crisis now. I hear the voice of
We are out of time for Radio EcoShock this week. My thanks to all the listeners who send in tips. The email address for me is radio@ecoshock.org, or contact me via the show website at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening this week and caring about our world.